G'day, humans. Welcome to the show that goes where others don't. The show that rejects partisan squabbling and tribal groupthink. I'm Josh Zepps. I'm your humble warrior princess, hunting down the world's most fascinating minds to wrestle with one provocative question each week. Much of modern culture and politics and media is tailor-made, especially social media, tailor-made to pander to what we already believe and distort what we don't, to reinforce our biases and exaggerate our differences. But change doesn't happen in an echo chamber. It's time to leave the mental comfort zone, to flex our minds and step on some landmines, folks. It's time to have uncomfortable conversations. Today on the show, do you remember by any chance this?
The only Republican member of Congress to call for President Trump's impeachment is leaving the GOP. Michigan Congressman Justin Amash has announced his plan to become an independent. He says modern politics is trapped in a, quote, partisan death spiral. President Trump called his departure great news for the Republican Party.
And now to a new twist.
Justin Amash was the first Republican to support the impeachment of Donald Trump during the Mueller inquiry. And that made him something of a hero to the anti-Trump Republicans and, needless to say, a target of horrendous hate from Trump himself and all of Trump's followers. And he had a front row seat, really, to seeing the total capitulation of the Republican Party away from his libertarian ideals and towards this craven, Trumpy populism that we've seen since 2016. He became a libertarian, and to this day, he remains the only libertarian who's held a congressional seat. He's not in Congress anymore. He didn't run again. Some people said, including Trump, that that was because he didn't think he'd win because he'd get primaried by a pro-Trump Republican. Amash doesn't think that that's true. He thinks he had a lot of support and he could have won, but he didn't want to be part of a party that was going in this direction. He considered running for president as a libertarian himself in 2020. In this conversation, he talks about his presidential ambitions prior to that, maybe even prior to 2016. Could things have gone differently, perhaps, if there'd been a charismatic, libertarian-minded Republican in the field instead of just Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Donald Trump? He hasn't ruled out running in 2024. A lot of smart money thinks that he may be the libertarian candidate in 2024. I ask him about that, but really I wanted to talk to him because I think there's an interesting crisis of conscience among people on the right, among conservatives, and I'm interested in talking to people who find themselves stuck in this intellectual space between ideals that they held about small government and what the new Republican Party has become. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with the first Republican, really, to stand up publicly against Trump, Justin Amash.
Are you nostalgic for that time? For that time of, like, I guess the world being run by the Mitt Romneys and Brent Scowcrofts of the world and, like, you know, George W. Bush Sr.
I'm not. Yeah, I'm not really nostalgic for any of that time. I mean, George W. Bush.
I meant to say H.W. Bush. Like, I'm going back to the old school.
No, guy. Even. Look, you can. You can respect people like H.W. Bush and say, you know, he was a statesman, et cetera. But at the same time, I think there was a lot of indifference at that time to the troubles people were facing in society. And, you know, I'm not sure that Obama and Trump actually addressed the real problems people are facing, but at least they made people feel like they were addressing those things. And I think that's been the difference in the new politics versus the old politics. Now, what I'd like to see is someone who talks about addressing these things, is talking about being an agent for change and actually is an agent for change. That really hasn't happened. We haven't seen that yet. But, you know, maybe we're moving in that direction where we start to elect people who are a little bit, you know, more unusual. They're willing to challenge the system and they're willing to stand up for what's right. You know, I mentioned Trump not really presenting that. You know, he talked about all these things, but if you look at policies, really deep down, the policies, when you look at Trump versus Obama versus Biden now, it's tweaking different things. These are not wholesale changes that you're seeing. And there can be a lot of excuses for why that is, or justifications, or whatever. But we haven't really seen someone who's willing to challenge the system.
I mean, when you talk about making real change in people's lives and helping people, normally the rhetoric around having big, major sort of radical change to the way that we do things comes from people on the left who believe in a robust government intervention into our lives, and like using things like Social Security to lift people up and providing benefits to people and trying to do a certain amount of, it's an unpolite way to put it, but social engineering to make sure that everybody is more equal. But as a libertarian, what does it look like to you to have a big change that helps people other than simply stopping government from doing things that you don't think it should be doing?
Well, I'd like to see more self-governance, first of all, but at the very least, when you look at something like the federal level, how about we just have an actual representative system, one where people can go to Congress and actually vote on things and represent people back home? Right now, you don't have that at all. And I think this is the most underreported thing right now in politics. And I've had conversations with, you know, major figures in the media telling them, why don't you cover this at all? Over the past decade, we've seen Congress move very far away from anything that represents sort of democratic ideals or a representative system. Right now you have the Speaker of the House. I can speak for the House because that's where I served, and the Senate has similar problems, but you know, I'm not an expert in Senate rules and the way the Senate operates, so I can speak for the House. In the House, you have one person, the Speaker of the House, who essentially decides everything that comes to the floor and decides what's going to be voted on, decides whether any amendments will be allowed. And since 2016, there actually haven't been any amendments on the House floor that are offered right on the House floor. And I think to people from other countries, and I don't know how this feels to you, for a lot of people from other countries who come from parliamentary systems and other types of systems, they say, well, what's the big deal? We elect parties and the parties go and represent us in sort of a coalition system. And I know when I've spoken to people from other countries, they feel like, well, their own elected officials don't really have that much independence. But here in the United States, we've had a long history and tradition of having representatives in Congress who stand on their own, who do what they believe in, who are there to represent their own community and aren't beholden to the leadership. And they can offer ideas that radically alter the system, ideas that shake things up. And in the past decade or so, we've moved so far from that, where we basically have like all of the bad aspects of a parliamentary system, but none of the benefits of it.
Clarify what this change is for people who haven't been paying attention to it. Are you talking about the aggressive posture of leaders of the House about whether or not they're even going to bring bills to the floor for a vote? Is this to do with not bringing it if it doesn't have majority support in the majority party?
Well, that's one aspect of it. These are rules that have sort of developed over time, informal rules, that something won't be brought to the floor, for example, if it doesn't have majority support, which
is,
of course, ridiculous.
What's that called, by the way, Justin? What's the name of that? Do you remember?
Well, they have the Hastert rule.
The Hastert rule, that's right. And this is kind of just Mitch McConnell being a dick, isn't it? I mean, like, to be blunt, that's not like in a parliamentary, I mean, yes, you're right that in a parliamentary system, it's frequently the case that the government, the party with the largest number of seats in the House of Representatives, is not going to bring legislation unless it suits it. But you can bring independent members' bills, and people frequently do, and the minority party can bring bills in, and you know, then the governing majority party finds itself between a rock and a hard place about whether or not it's going to allow a conscience vote. From, you know, occasionally you'll have things that are so sensitive, whether it's about abortion or euthanasia or gay rights or something like that, where the parties will just drop their standard policy and allow each individual member to vote however they want to. Traditionally, I'm just articulating this for people who don't really know the American system that well. Traditionally, as I understand, it's been the case that in the U.S. House of Representatives, everyone can vote on a bill, and whatever the largest number of people in the chamber vote for is the way that it's supposed to go. But since the past decade or so, Mitch McConnell has basically said, I'm not even going to allow votes on things that the House wants to pass unless it also has a majority of people within my own party. So there's not even going to be an opportunity to enact the will of the people unless my tribe likes it.
This is true of Mitch McConnell and Schumer in the Senate, but again in the House we're talking about John Boehner, Paul Ryan, Nancy Pelosi, people who have served as Speaker of the House on the House side, and
is the Hastert rule that I don't get tied up in pretzel shapes? Is the Hastert rule a Senate rule or a House rule?
Well, I don't know if Hastert was a Speaker of the House, so okay, we know so it exists in the House.
I've just thrown Mitch McConnell under a bus, perhaps unfairly.
We should throw Mitch McConnell under the bus anyways. But,
metaphorically speaking, people, don't send hate mail.
Yes, not literally. Violence. But the Hastert rule, I think, originated in the House, and at least as far as I know, it is a House sort of idea. But it's an informal rule, but it's only one aspect of the problem. I mean, the way I view Congress as a libertarian is that it should be a place where outcomes are discovered, not dictated. Libertarians believe in generally ideas of self-governance. We believe in decentralization, moving as much away from Washington as possible and closer to home. But where we do have governance at the federal level, when you're going to have it on a lot of issues, like the armed forces is an example, right? National defense is one example. Or, there are obviously broad appropriations measures that might apply to the whole country. Where you do have those things, there should be a discovery process. It shouldn't be dictated by leaders. In other words, you put some kind of baseline legislation on the floor, and leaders are going to obviously somewhat determine what comes to the floor in that respect, what kind of baseline legislation. But then open up the process is what they should do. They should say, after they put it on the floor, bring your ideas to the floor. Let's find out what the outcome is. And if the outcome is something different from what congressional leaders envisioned, that's okay. And if the bill comes to the floor and it's amended and then the final product doesn't pass, that's okay too. I mean, that's all part of the process. And to libertarians, this is sort of how we envision a system working where we can all live together, even though we have different priorities. It's that you just have a set of rules that apply equally to everyone, and you offer your ideas, and we can discuss them in a peaceful way. And we may not get the outcome we want, and very frequently we won't get the outcome we want. But I'll tell you what, as a libertarian, I'm going to get the outcome I want a lot more under an open system than under a closed system.
When you say, Justin, when
I
you
do
say,
believe in my ideas.
When you say as a libertarian, you've been a libertarian for 3 seconds in political time. You were a Republican up until 2020.
I've been a Libertarian Party member for a short period of time, but I was a Republican, but I was a Libertarian Republican. So libertarian philosophically.
Got it.
And which would be like, for those listening at home, it'd be more like classical liberalism is, I guess, a way to think about it. I don't know what the term means to the typical Australian, as an example.
No, I think it would be the same. I think it would be broadly the same. I mean, the term has become somewhat tarnished, I guess, in recent years by being co-opted by a certain wild-eyed, of very aggressively gun-toting anti-government, like conspiracy theorist-minded person. But I think most people still understand the pure term of something like libertarianism. But when you got to Washington after having been in the state House were you expecting to find the kind of world that you're articulating? Because the way you describe what you want the people's chamber to be sounds like Goldilocks skipping through the woods, having expectations of a kind of ancient Greek idol of democracy, of the demos, that just does not map onto reality.
Well, admittedly, when I entered Congress, I was 30 years old, so not, you know, particularly...
Not that age different from Goldilocks.
Right. So I was a young member of Congress, one of the youngest. I think I was the second oldest member at the time. So I did come in a little bit bright-eyed with these ideas about how the system should work. You know, we all watch Schoolhouse Rock, and we think about how a bill is made. And you do come into it thinking, okay, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to talk about ideas and I'm going to read all the legislation and I'm going to really understand this stuff. And I'm going to present my ideas to my colleagues and I'm going to persuade them. And I did come in with that sort of sense. And I had some reason to believe it would work something like that because I had served in the state legislature. And although the state legislature wasn't some kind of utopia, it was a more open place where I could go as a Republican legislator and speak to the Democratic leadership who were in control of the chamber at the time and tell them I had an idea and that idea could get onto the House floor for a vote. Hmm. Or I could tell the Democratic leadership, hey, I think there's something wrong with your bill. You haven't thought through the unintended consequence of this, you know, provision. And I've had them hold up legislation in the Democratic-led chamber in the State House where they said, yeah, you're right. We didn't think about that carefully enough. We're going to pull the legislation for a week or two to work on it. I offered amendments in the State House and frequently had my amendments adopted. You know, it was like almost half the time, I think, my amendments were adopted in the State House. And that was in a majority Democratic chamber. So I did come in with this idea that with, you know, principled persuasion, you could work with people, you could bring them to your ideas and make a difference. And admittedly, when I got to Congress, there was some sign that maybe you could persuade people because we were voting more frequently on amendments. I remember when I first got there, one of the first pieces of legislation we voted on, I'm not sure if it was the very first one, but it was one of the first ones. We had, I don't know, hundreds of amendments, if I recall correctly, that we could just offer freely on the floor. We could just walk to the House floor, offer our amendments, and people.
And this was people liked it. Yeah, just to set this up in time. Yeah, this is 2010. You came in the huge Republican wave of the backlash against Obama after the financial crisis in 2010. Is that right? I suppose the Tea Party wave of.
That's right. Yeah. So this would be 2011, and I was viewed as one of the new Tea Party members of Congress. I was a libertarian, which there are distinctions, but the Tea Party movement at the time had in many parts of it, at least, a very libertarian flavor to it.
What did it mean to you, Justin, to be part of that movement? Like, what did you conceive of it as calling for?
Limited government, self-governance, free markets.
And were you pissed at Obama at the time? What was he doing that was aggravating you?
Are you talking about the president, Obama?
Yeah.
So spending too much. Obamacare had been passed just before then, so that was an example of the government intervening in our health system in a way that I thought was not appropriate or ideal, not suited really to our system. I don't think they actually fixed the problems with our health system by passing that. So it was just a general sense that the government was assuming too much power and spending too much money. And we were losing a lot of our community autonomy, like as communities across the country. You know, the United States is a big place with over 300 million people. And the idea that you're going to have someone in Washington or a small group of people in Washington dictating everything to the whole country is not something I support or believe in, because it's I think it's harmful to what makes America actually great, which is our diversity. You know, we have a diverse country with people who have different ideas and different ways of living and different cultures, and we should embrace all of that. And when you centralize everything in one place, you're actually cutting against diversity. It's ironically something Democrats often talk about, like they love diversity, but the idea of centralization is anti-diversity by nature. Like the idea is, we don't believe in your diversity. We're going to decide everything in one place and dictate it to everyone. Mm. And so that really was something that I was against, that sort of centralization. So I entered Congress as part of this Tea Party wave. But, you know, there were other people within the Tea Party movement who maybe had more nationalistic views of things. I'm certainly not nationalistic in that sense. If anything, I'm be the opposite of nationalistic. You know, I don't believe in centralizing things like culture or, you know, sort of this identity of self.
I mean, so, that's an interesting, you know, side angle to your comment about diversity as well, which I think is a good point. There's often a lot of hypocrisy on the left about what diversity means. I mean, I've run into constant experiences in the media where there's endless hand-wringing and, you know, self-consciousness about making sure that, for example, a panel is really diverse. And you frequently end up with people who look very, very diverse and they sort of tick the identitarian checkboxes and they're all saying the same thing. And they say, well, right, what kind of, you know, by what metric are we measuring diversity here? It's great that you've got a lot of women of color and you've got a trans person and everything, but they all believe this basically the same thing. Like, should we also consider diversity of opinion, diversity of thought? I mean, I think the left-wing pushback to your claim about central government not respecting diversity is that amid diversity, one way to make diversity flourish is for there to be minimum baselines of well-being that only a central government can assure. Now, that doesn't mean that the US government does it particularly well, but in a lot of social democracies, you might say, nobody's going to go bankrupt after getting hit by a car, so we're going to have some kind of universal healthcare system that may not be perfect, but it's going to provide this level of baseline. Maybe Obamacare wasn't that, but something could be. And that something is something that you would still object to as a libertarian.
Well, I think it's important to think about the size of the United States. So when you look at countries in Europe, or if you look at Australia, even, they're much smaller countries. You know, California itself would be a relatively large country in other parts of the world. So we have these states in the United States, 50 different states, that are actually pretty populous. You know, they're pretty large states. And one of the brilliant instincts of the founders was to allow these states essentially to compete with each other, to maintain their own sense of how they're going to handle difficult issues, so that you actually get a variety of options out there, a variety of solutions, and they can learn from each other. And when you centralize everything, you might end up creating a system that is bad and bad for everyone and then harmful to everyone. And so I understand the argument for healthcare, for example, saying, well, we need to have some kind of baseline. I understand all that, but I don't think the way to do it is as through the federal government and having some kind of federal standard that cuts across the whole United States. There are ways to do it through states acting on their own or through markets that I think would achieve many of the same outcomes that people desire without the drawbacks.
Right.
But in any case, also, the idea
let me just briefly, as an aside, yeah, note my objection to the size argument, which comes up all the time when I talk to Americans. I just sort of call moderate bullshit on it, in the sense that you're right. Like, the European Union is 450 million people to America's 330. I know it's not the same country, but it's all they have figured out a way collectively to provide extraordinarily complicated services. And everything, I think, is scalable. I mean, if a country of 1 million people, there are certain things a country of 1 million people can't do, and certain things that a country of 330 million people can do. But if you have 330 million people, you have a much larger tax base to be able to fund things through. So it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to organize and coordinate everything from a central planning committee, because it might be too big to do that. But only the dumbest social democrat in the world or a true communist would be trying to do that. Most social democrats and European style welfare state people would say, of course, delegate to local communities and to states how they distribute, how they get the job done, but provide centralized requirements that if you are living in, you know, Australia or Denmark or Canada, then you're going to be entitled to X. And if you want to be a libertarian about how that X gets decided and delivered and managed and handled, that can be as close to the beneficiary as you want it to be. It doesn't have to be coming from some Politburo, but you can set baseline standards. And, you know, one example just to wrap up this rant that I sometimes give to Americans is, if you think that, like, oh, America's just too vast and complicated for something like Medicare for All to ever work, there's no way, it would just end up in a tangle. I say just imagine a parallel universe in which the US is not a military behemoth and has a sort of Costa Rican military attitude with very, very low spending on the military. And someone comes along and says, you know what, the United States should have a military that as a proportion of its GDP and its population is significantly larger than any other democracy. Americans would say, what are you talking about? We're way too big for that. There's no way that we could afford it. Can you imagine how much it would cost? What about the logistics? Where would we put all the plants? And, well, now we live in that alternative world universe where all 50 states have massive military industrial complexes and trillions of dollars get spent on the military. And it is possible because someone decided to make it possible. I'm not saying it's desirable, but I'm saying that the population and size has not proven to be an impediment.
Well, first, I would say that the European countries have a lot of autonomy still. I mean, they are part of a union, but they've maintained a lot of autonomy. And the ultimate conclusion of where we're going would be having a one world government. I mean, if you're going to say that, well, it makes sense to have the United States decide everything as a whole or Europe decide everything as a whole, and I don't see what the argument is against a one world government where the people of the United States and the people of Europe would actually be a small percentage of the total population, and they'd have their lives essentially dictated by people across the world. Which brings me to another point that I think is often missed when it comes to size, which is that people talk about it but forget the political aspects. People don't like being ruled by people who are far away from them. They don't like the idea of someone far away deciding things. So even if it were practical from the sense of, you know, we can actually do this, we can gather the tax base, and we can efficiently find a way to dole out the resources, it's not practical from a political standpoint. It creates tension. And that tension is harmful to our system overall. And we've seen that actually ramp up in recent years. I mean, all of the fighting we're seeing now in the United States between Republicans and Democrats, between the Trump people and the Biden people and people who hate Trump and people who hate Biden, it has to do with how much power we've put in one place, the federal government. And if that federal government didn't have all that power, a lot of this stuff would dissipate. You wouldn't have all of the political tension. So I think we can't just think about it in terms of, you know, what could actually work. Like, could it, you know, just from like ignoring human nature, what could work just on paper? Mm. You have to think about human beings being involved, and humans just don't like to be ruled by people who are far away from them or super different from them. Just like I think Europeans or Australians or Americans would not like to have a one world government where maybe Asia is in control of it because they have just a massive population.
Mm. No, I think that's a good point. And I guess the extent to which people resent being ruled from Washington, D.C. would have to be greater than the extent to which they feel resentful and disrupted by the circumstances that are beyond their control, that they feel that nobody is doing anything about. And that frustration, I would argue, sometimes comes from a failure of leadership. And so there are two things, there are two potential factors that could cause the kind of disruption and partisanship and hate that we're seeing in American politics at the moment. One, I'll grant you, could be that, you know, power is being wielded by abstract forces too far away from them. And the other could be that government just isn't doing anything very constructive, and so they feel like they're adrift. And if there was a good, competent central government, if there was, you know, I don't know what the example would be right now, but I suppose maybe if you appeal to, like, I don't know, 1980s or 1990s style governance in the United States, then perhaps arguably people would feel like their lives were more on the right track, and that resentment would soften their hatred somewhat. But this is all getting a little bit academic.
Yeah, maybe, but we live in a different world because of social media, and I think there's no way to go back to that time. You know, people want to go back to that time, and I hear that a lot. If only we could recreate those days, because it seemed more peaceful and people got along more and all that. But part of the problem is social media has connected us all across the country. And now people are arguing about things that have nothing to do with themselves. Like, yeah. You know, like something happens in some far off city and you're complaining about it. You know, people will see on the news that someone was shoplifting in San Francisco and they'll lose their minds. Yes. Even though, like, you know, you live in some other part of the country, you live in, you know, Georgia or something. Mm. Like, what does it have to do with you? So now we're like in a world where we fight over some obscure mayor from some city, or some obscure, you know, police chief somewhere, because I don't know, we just want to be mad about things. And I don't think there's a way to really go back. I think the only thing we can do to reduce the tension actually is to embrace a sort of decentralization. And that doesn't mean, I think, some kind of radical, hands-off approach where, like, nobody is connected to anyone else anymore in the country. If anything, I think it means more diversity, more embracing of other cultures and other people, because you start to develop a respect for people when you don't feel like everything's being shoved down your throat. And I think that we can move to a better place if we would just stop being involved with each other over every minuscule.
It is terrifying. Like the nationalization of all conversation.
It's becoming international too.
Yeah, totally.
Like look at all the people in the United States, whether it comes to, whether it's Australia or Canada, like everything is like now, making everyone mad.
Yeah.
About,
you know, absolutely. Like, no, I mean, yeah, the Canadian truckers are, you know, a global story. The Australian lockdowns were a global story, you know, and, you know, the culture wars in America have managed to piggyback on America's success as a cultural empire and sort of infiltrate all of the way that we talk everywhere about things like race and, you know, transgenderism and things like that. These rather arcane conversations that generally inhabit university-educated white progressives in Brooklyn and, like, the Bay Area of California. These are now the way that people talk about things everywhere in the world. And, yeah, I don't know how – I mean, I share your desire for greater diversity, greater localism, greater expressions of sort of local sentiment and can-do attitudes that actually fix local problems. So let's get, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about your worldview and this, the way that you're talking about things here is, I can't remember when I first noticed you, but one of my problems with the wave of opposition to the Obama administration that you were part of when you came in was that a lot of your colleagues and supporters, I felt, were just being hypocrites about which bits of government they wanted and which bits they didn't want. Like, there was a lot of, like, oh, Medicare is fine, and, like, you know, the military budget is fine, but, and, you know, even public education is fine, and all these other things that strike me as being somewhat arbitrary that a government would be doing. Like, it wasn't inevitable that old people should get free healthcare. It wasn't inevitable that schools should get public funding, but hospitals shouldn't. Like, things are contingent. They've gone other ways in other countries. I mean, imagine if in America, instead of there being public schools, there were public hospitals and everybody paid for school. And then a president came along like Obama who wanted to do Obama schools instead of Obama care and provide public funding for schools, and everyone would be going crazy. Like, it seemed like there was no underpinning principle except for fury, except for just a sense of, like, this far and no further. Was that, but then I get a sense when, I don't remember when I noticed you, but I did notice that at least you seemed to be more reactionary. And I mean that in sort of a good way, in the sense that you were like, no, it's not just that we're going too far right now. It's actually that the whole edifice of what we have sort of outsourced to the government to do has to be rethought. Is that a fair way of putting it? Like, should we start, like, should Medicare be abolished?
I think that you should move away from systems like that. When you ask things like, should it be abolished? I think people get the impression that you're going to introduce a bill that tomorrow gets rid of Medicare without thinking through the consequences. And I don't think libertarians who are serious about that, about libertarianism, operate that way. In other words, it would be a whole process working through how are we going to address the shock that would happen. You know, there'd obviously be a shock to the system when you change things that have been built up over many years. So I do believe in having a very different system from what we have. And I believe that you can get there through localism, but I do not believe that it would entail the types of shocks that people think they would face, because you would do it incrementally and you would do it through states acting up where the federal government loses power. So, for example, you might reduce federal taxation but increase taxation at the state level. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that if the people of that community decide that they want to do that. I do think that there is something inherently wrong with continuously moving everything toward the highest level possible. I think that's dangerous for our country and dangerous for individuals. So I would love to see a system where we move taxation as close to home as possible. You might, for example, have the local government having the highest level of taxation and the federal government having the lowest level of taxation, which is the opposite of how it works right now. But it doesn't necessarily mean no taxation whatsoever. Because I look at this stuff all as a sort of scale, right? Like it's like it's not like there's government or no government.
Mm.
There's just governance at different levels, and we all form governing organizations to make decisions. Sometimes they're very small organizations. Sometimes they're not voluntary. Like you're born into a family that makes decisions, right?
Right.
It's another form of governance. You might have
tell
been,
my four-year-olds, you know, that. Yeah, they're fully aware this is a tyrannical dictatorship that I'm running in my household.
Right, and you might run your house like a dictatorship, and that's a lot of parents do. That might be how it works at home. But as you get to higher levels of governance, like the federal government, you obviously want to have less control at that level, where they have less control over your daily life. And more, and you naturally have more of an ability to, or you have less of ability when it's at the federal level to get away. So you want to make sure that it's limited in its scope. When you have a local government or something very close to you, you have more of an ability to escape it.
Yeah. And we're seeing that at a state level. I mean, there's been a huge exodus over the course of the pandemic from states that people feel were, mishandled it to states that people feel did better. I know about four friends who've left California to move to Texas.
And it's a good thing that we have a country still where you can do that, where someone can move from one part of the country to another part of the country because they believe that the system they have in their own state is not the best system. They prefer some other system. I think that's a good thing. If you make it all uniform, I think that's a problem, where the whole United States has one system and you can't escape it. And then it's just like an all-out fight for who has control of the levers.
Justin, what would the federal government do? I understand your reticence in it sort of throwing bombs on yourself that you're going to have to then clean up by saying something that sounds like you want to detonate Medicare right now. But let's park the how we get there and just talk pure political philosophy for a second. What's the proper role of a federal government in a state like the United States? Should it be just about securing the borders and basically having courts and things to resolve contractual disputes and a police force to enforce the law and all welfare, food stamps, public schools, hospitals and things like that? You know, Medicare for old people should not be part of its purview?
Well, the Constitution provides the blueprint. The federal government should be focused on things that actually have national scope. In other words, something like defense of the country, like the armed forces, has national scope. And that doesn't matter whether you're in a state of five people or a state of 5 million people or 50 million people. You want to be protected against foreign invasion or foreign attack. You have a similar outlook on the issue. So where there's a lot of cohesion, where there's a lot of similarity in how people view the issue, you'd have the federal government involved. And I think the framers of the Constitution did a pretty good job of figuring out where that is. And it's primarily in areas of national defense. To some extent, they were concerned about commerce, and they sort of established the United States as a free trade zone. And so they gave the federal government some supremacy to ensure that goods could flow freely across the states. So there are a few areas where I think they rightly thought, hey, the federal government could have a role here to ensure that there's something that benefits the maximum number of people, where most people are going to agree on the issue. The average person will agree. But then when you get into details about people's lives, and this could include healthcare, because the way people live their lives in a rural part of the country is not the same as someone in an urban area like New York City. So when you get into sort of these sorts of issues, and there are lots of issues besides healthcare, of course. Mm. But when you get into these sorts of issues, you want local governments to make more of the decisions, or states or individuals. Mm. You just want to bring it to the lowest level possible, where they can, do something that has like a majority or some kind of consensus for the issue, And I don't see that at the federal level. You don't really have a lot of consensus on most of the things we're fighting about.
You certainly don't. And I mean, that would be an argument for keeping the things that you try to do at a national level as universal as possible, right? I mean, I think your one thing that you're pointing to that I noticed as a non-American living in America was how delusional the American left is about what they think other social democracies are like. Like they really think that it's milk and honey and like free everything for everyone in Denmark and Canada. And I've lived in Denmark. I went to university there for a semester, and I've lived in Australia, which is basically Canada. And, you know, it's not. If you wanted to create Medicare for all in America the way that American progressives think that you would bankrupt America, because the health system is so unrestrained and incredibly overly opulent in the States. I mean, not in a good way. I just mean that so much is covered by private health insurance there. I mean, I had an experience where I was working at HuffPost in New York, and there was like some company that gave like spinal back sort of massages and like orthopedic type analyses. And they came in for free at one lunchtime, got me to sign up for like a weekly massage. I did like 10 weeks of this weekly massage with this little machine that would go boom, 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 boom down my back, and felt really nice. And when I finally saw the invoice that they'd invoiced to my private health insurer, it was something like $15,000 for 10 weeks. And there was no like clinical reason for this thing. There was a copay that I had supposedly been paying that I hadn't been paying, but they don't mind not taking the copay, of course, because they get the money from the... And like, I just found this again and again and again, that there's a system where there's really no... There are none of the normal cost controls that either a private system or a well-run public system should have in place. It's this crazy sort of hybrid. And I think a lot of American leftists think that they could just have all of that and it would be free. The reality is in a well-run free healthcare system like Australia has, which is the one that I know the best, which is also called Medicare, and I have a Medicare card, everyone has a Medicare card,
you don't get just whatever you want. Like, you know, you talk to your doctor and the doctor will prescribe things. Any specialist you see has to go through your family doctor, your primary care physician, which means that there are gatekeepers inside the system to make sure that costs don't balloon. I can't just go and get an MRI because I'm scared of it. And a lot of Americans, I think, would feel like that's an imposition on their on the way that they've come to understand healthcare. They should be able to get a procedure done just because they're worried about it. And doctors should be working in the service of the patients, and the patient's consideration should be the only consideration. There should never be a financial consideration. That's not the mindset of doctors who work in a publicly funded system. Of course, they want to look after their patients, but not at any cost, not at a cost of like bankrupting the state. So I'm sort of granting you that the complexity of a centralized public system is, you know, the more complex it gets, the more deranged it becomes from a practical application to people's lives at a granular level. I just don't think that that means that you can't do it at all. I just think it means that you have to agree on simple baselines, like, okay, well, you know, emergency public hospital care, you know, at the very least, let's make sure that anybody who is in an emergency gets treated for free, for example, and doesn't have to pay it back.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people do not realize, you know, what are the trade-offs, and there are people who might say those trade-offs are just fine, but I think a lot of Americans would say, no, that's not fine. And when I look at the United States, and I, you know, I'm on Twitter and I see the more extreme end of it when you're on Twitter.
Mm. you could say that again.
You see people who are so diametrically opposed on a lot of these things that I'm not sure how you would ever create one system that works for all of them. The left, when I'm on Twitter, when they think about the right, I feel like they think these people are, you know, like horrible people who shouldn't exist. I mean, these are the comments I get on Twitter, and the stuff you get from the right. Similarly, like they think the left are, you know, beyond stupid or naive or gullible or whatever it might be. Mm. And I'm not sure how you resolve any of that through some kind of one size fits all system. Like, I don't know how you get anywhere with a system like that. I don't know how it doesn't just increase the tensions overall, because people have such different ways of living in the United States and such different perspectives on things that, you know, I think people are sort of naive about this.
Yeah.
And part of that naivety comes from when you look at a lot of people on the left in the United States, they tend to live in very concentrated areas like urban centers, New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago. They live in areas where they run into people who are like them every day, who agree with them on things politically. So when they hear about someone who has a different perspective, they can't even relate to it at all. Mm. They don't even know anyone who has that perspective. Mm. I think actually there's some sense in which people on the right have a better understanding of people on the left than people on the left do of people on the right.
I think that's true. I mean, I've said that for a long time. Yeah.
And I say this as someone who, I mean, I don't have, you know, much affection for what the sort of hard right does in the United States and the politics of it and all that. You know, I've been very much against Trumpism and this national populism that's arisen out of it. And at the same time, I recognize, because I've been at the receiving end of so much of the animosity from both the right and the left, I can see that the people on the right tend to think that I'm just stupid or naive when they criticize me. And the people on the left tend to think I am evil or I have some kind of ill motive. Right. Sometimes you'll be accused of racism. Like, whatever the case may be, there is this view on the left that if someone doesn't share their values, that person is a bad human being.
Yeah, or even if a person has a different idea about the means to get to common values. I mean, I think you can actually test this by just asking people to articulate the worldview of their opponent and see how well they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I mean, and if you ask most conservatives, I think I'm not talking about, you know, far right people, but if you ask most conservatives what a progressive's worldview is, they're likely to do a fairly good job of saying that the progressive thinks that government should be used to help people and to lift people up, and that, you know, that conservatives are mean, and that that progressives care about people and want to make life easier for people who have been traditionally sidelined or something like that, you know, which is a broadly true, not caricature, but like characterization of the progressive worldview. But if you ask a progressive what a conservative thinks, I don't think that they will be able, they're less likely to be able to say that the conservative feels that attempts to use government to fix problems are likely to cause more problems than progressives believe that they will, that the best arrangements over the course of, you know, over the long arc of history have tended to be ones that allowed people to make more localized choices for themselves and to feel freer, even if that comes with, you know, certain the trade-offs of individualism or whatever it might be. The progressive is likely to say, conservatives want money for rich people, and yeah, they're mean, and they don't care about poor people. Which, of course, is not the way that conservatives think of themselves. So, you know, you've got an impasse there between what you even think that you're in opposition to. But I want to talk, since we're talking, you know, I mean, I don't even know where to get into Trump. Why don't we start by just talking about what you... So you're in Congress. You know, it's not functioning necessarily the way that you think that it ought to in the second term of Obama. Let's go to there. So 2012, 2013, 14, 15. As the Republican primaries begin, did you think about throwing your hat in the ring and running in 2016, by the way?
Yeah, I actually did. It's something I don't really talk about. I'm not sure I've ever talked about it. But I did think about... at that time, even running as a libertarian.
Hmm.
And, you know, I talked it over with family and a few people, a few friends, and ultimately decided against it. And actually, it's maybe one of my biggest regrets in my life.
Not running as a libertarian or not running as a Republican?
Not running as a libertarian. I think that by the time I felt really strongly about it, you know, that I should jump into this thing. The Republican primary had already moved. I hadn't really thought about, you know, jumping into it initially. But as I start to see that this was headed toward maybe a Hillary Clinton-Donald Trump matchup, where you had two people who were so, you know, disliked by the public generally. I mean, we had polling on this just in my district, and the polling was astonishing to me. Like, my approval rating was way above water, you know, like it was quite high. My disapproval was low. Then I would poll on Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and the approval was like 20% for each one and 60% disapproval. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, how could two people so reviled by so many people be the nominees for the party? And so I did have some inclination at that time, like maybe I should jump into this race, and ultimately decided against it. But the only reason I would have done it at the time is because I was ready to starting to see that Congress was headed in the wrong direction. You know, even a few years ago, like, you know, say 2015, 2016, I was already thinking about getting out of Congress. Like, you know, this is not the type of body I envisioned when I entered Congress. You know, it's not really a place of legislative activity anymore. It's more just, you know, pushing a button that someone tells me to push, and then I push the other button, and then they get mad at me. And so there wasn't really much there for me. Like, you couldn't actually offer amendments. You couldn't get your legislation on the floor. So I was already thinking about maybe I need to try something else to shake this up, because ultimately what I'm trying to do is improve the system. I'm an introvert by nature. Like, politics is actually not what I would naturally want to get into at all. I got into it with the understanding that this was not my forte. This was not what I was comfortable with. And the country was too important. You know, I'm the son of a refugee and the son of an immigrant. My dad's a Palestinian refugee and my mom is a Syrian immigrant. And so for me, keeping the American dream alive is so important. And I convinced myself that I need to get into this, even though it's not comfortable for me, even though I don't like politics, even though I don't, you know, like all this stuff where I have to go give speeches and be in large crowds and all, like, 'cause I'm an introvert by nature. I said, I'm going to do it anyways. And I felt, you know, around 2015 or so, 2016, hey, Congress wasn't really turning out to be what I thought it would be. You know, I'm not able to, even though I've sacrificed a lot by coming here because I don't, it's not like my cup of tea. It's not turning out the way I thought. And I was about to maybe take another adventure and say like, well, maybe I have to run for president, even though I'm also not comfortable with that.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Justin, if the reason you don't like politics is because you're an introvert who doesn't like giving speeches in front of big crowds, then going from the House of Representatives to the presidential political campaigning is...
I could
talk to you about career choices, young man.
Believe me, I know. And being a libertarian also, like, is a part of that, right? Like, libertarians are all about privacy and individualism. And you know, so, living free and all that. And like when you run for office, especially if you ran for president, you lose all of that. Like, I can't go out to dinner anymore. I can't, you know. So like, I really am, you know.
And so just
naturally
put me in your head then, Justin. It's 2015. And I guess Jeb Bush is going to be the nominee. And there's Marco Rubio, and then, you know, there are a few other people. We had, you know, Herman Cain and, you know, some people like that, I guess, were floating around. You know, Ted Cruz, I don't think anyone, I don't know about you, but I don't think anyone serious thought that Ted Cruz was going to be a popular politician at a presidential level. And then there's, you know, Trump is just this crazy sideshow that clearly is not going to get the nomination. At that point, do you think to yourself, I can probably give Jeb Bush a run for his money?
No, I wasn't gonna, you know, I wasn't supportive of Jeb Bush, but I also wasn't thinking let's jump in against Jeb Bush. Like, I didn't know how it would turn out, but I didn't feel like he had the juice really to get through it, and I wasn't sure how it was gonna go. At the time, I was supporting Rand Paul,
right? Of course,
who was a friend and ally and certainly more on the libertarian side of things, especially at that time. And so I was supportive of him. And from my perspective, look, he was claiming the libertarian Republican lane there. And
right. Look, I was going to give to jump in would have been to screw him.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think that we can't have too many people in that lane. If we want to be successful, let's let him pursue it. He was obviously interested in pursuing it long before I was. So,
and has he now had to basically abandon that lane and become a sort of Trumpy bootlicker, and you've had to exit the party?
Well, I don't want to frame it that way, but I would say he's definitely jumped onto the Trump bandwagon. I mean,
do you talk to him about that? Have you spoken to him?
I've spoken to him a few times. Not since I've left Congress, I have not, but you know, in the later days of my time in Congress, and you know, we've always had a friendly relationship, and you know, I don't have anything bad to say about him in that respect. You know, like, our relationship's been good. I've always been a bit disappointed, and it's a strategic issue, right? Like, he made a strategic call about how to proceed. And I don't agree with it, and I'm sure he doesn't agree with my strategic approach on the whole thing. But there came a point where he decided that going with Trump was more fruitful than going against Trump. And I, to this day, do not believe that. I think that's a mistake for libertarianism. It's a mistake for spreading our ideas. And I think I've been proven right on all of this. I mean, unfortunately, Trump has been associated with libertarian thinking without any justification, because a lot of libertarians jumped on the bandwagon and said, yeah, he's, you know, I'm with him. And I think that has hurt libertarianism, because now there's this caricature of libertarianism that it's something like Trumpism. And I think that's very damaging to the brand, because it's nothing like Trumpism. So you get the worst of all worlds. You get Trump, who wasn't libertarian in almost any respect from a governance standpoint, and then now you're tying libertarianism to it, and he's also a guy that is generally disliked by a lot of people. His MO is to divide people rather than bring people together. Mm. And libertarianism to me is about human cooperation. So I was disappointed. And especially because Rand Paul in the early days, one of the ironies I think is that when he was running against Trump in the debates, I would tell Rand, I think you're focusing too much on Trump, because he would take shots at Trump all the time. He'd go into the debates and he'd take a shot at Trump. I'm like, Rand, they're only giving you like a minute or two to speak and you're spending it all taking shots at Trump. You got to like cool it a little bit, focus on what you want to get across. What's the message you want to get across? It can't just be Trump is bad. So the irony is I was telling him that at the time. And then as soon as he became the nominee, I mean, at least shortly thereafter, things really changed. Like I was never supportive of Trump, but I at least understood why in the debates you might want to focus on your own message and stop worrying about Trump. But then as soon as he became the president, the nominee and then the president, you've got to stand up for what you believe in. You, just because it's a Republican doesn't mean we're just going to, walk away and let him do whatever he wants. And
why did so many people?
I think he captured the imagination of the Republican base. And then there was no fighting it.
Right.
For basically any of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, you were the first Republican congressman to call for his impeachment.
Yeah, but
so
I also
was some fighting it.
I also was someone who from the very beginning in my district had really prepared them for this. Like nobody in my district was really caught off guard that I might support impeachment of a president for executive overreach. I mean, it's like I've been talking about this stuff for years and would hold lots of town halls. People knew pretty well where I stood on executive overreach and abuses of power. It wasn't like I was going to be like, well, he's a Republican and so we're good to go. I mean, I'd been criticizing my own party for many years already. I criticized Republican leadership so many times. And I had been hoping that some of my sort of Tea Party colleagues who were also willing to criticize Republican leadership would be willing to criticize Trump. And a lot of them said they would be willing to. I mean, I remember during the presidential race where a lot of them, after he became the nominee, would say, if Trump wins, we'll have the chance to prove that we'll stand up against someone from our own party who does the wrong thing. But then as soon as he became president, at least shortly thereafter, that all fell apart. And it was pretty gradual in the first couple of years, and then it fell apart very swiftly toward the end of 2018, I would say. Mm. But it was, it was tough, but nobody should have been surprised by my take on it.
No, but I mean, I guess there was a backlash there of some kind in the sense that you left the Republican Party and you didn't run again.
Yeah, but to me, it was less about could I be successful in my district as a Republican? I believed I could because I had been very active in the district in terms of holding town halls, being engaged with people, answering their questions, explaining my votes. I'd been very engaged in that stuff for many years. I think it would have been a tougher race than I faced before, but I think that's one I could have won as well if I had run for re-election as a Republican. But I really lost interest in being a Republican at the time.
Well, also, when you say if you'd run as a Republican, wouldn't you have to have won a primary in order to run in the general as a Republican? And wouldn't you have gotten primaried from some Trumper who
I was already going to be, people already lining up. As soon as I said Trump, you should face impeachment, the people already lining up to jump in. And even before that, there are people who thought I was not sufficiently supportive of Donald Trump who were probably going to jump in even if I didn't support impeachment. But I believed in my district. I believe the people know me, understand me, and that I could have won that primary again. But there are a lot of people throughout the country who had not prepared their district for this. Like if you were very partisan from the beginning, you were not, your district was not prepared for this. Like, you were not prepared
for what, for Trump or for the capitulation of the Republican Party to Trump?
I'm saying elected officials, members of Congress who didn't prepare their district for the idea that there could be a bad Republican were not in a position then to tell their district, okay, now we have a bad Republican. We have to stand up against him.
Right.
They were so partisan for so many years that to do so would have been like a political suicide.
Right. I can actually understand that.
Of
tribal party loyalty rather than, ideas and governance.
They'd essentially trained their voters. Like, if you think about it, in my district for years, I had been saying to my voters, I represent all of you. I don't care if you're a Republican, a Democrat. I was willing to challenge my own Republican leadership. I was willing to support Democratic positions that I thought were right. I'd taken on immigration is a good example, where I'd taken positions at times that upset the Republican base, some civil liberties issues, including things like, challenging police abuses. So I'd taken positions already that showed I was willing to challenge my own party. So my constituents knew where I was coming from, and they were electing me every year, both in the primary and in the general, by overwhelming margins. So they knew where I was at. But if you look at another Republican, they had been training their district for several years that Democrats were the total problem. Republicans were not so bad. Republicans were good. We're not going to criticize Republicans. When they talk about who they represent, they talk about representing Republican voters. They would ignore the Democrats. They had a very different view of representation than I did. And so their whole base was just Republican voters. If you polled their district, the Democratic support for them was very low. Whereas in my district, I always had pretty good Democratic support. I had pretty good crossover support and certainly very strong independent support. But for my colleagues in the Republican Party, the vast majority of them, they're basically getting all of their votes from Republicans and none of their votes from anywhere else.
Right.
So if they turn on their own base, if they say, hey, our Republican is a bad guy, they're not winning over the Democrats. Those people are not coming over. At least not in large numbers, and neither are the independents. And the Republicans are going to be like, hey, what? This is not what we signed up for. Like, what is the? Who is this guy?
We
signed up for the guy who's partisan.
Justin, when you declared your independence and said that you were leaving the Republican Party and said that you were disenchanted with party politics, the President Trump, in all of his magnanimity and graciousness, tweeted, knew he couldn't get the nomination to run again in the great state of Michigan, already being challenged for his seat, a total loser. Great news for the Republican Party, as one of the dumbest and most disloyal men in Congress is quitting the party, Trump tweeted about you. Did that surprise you? Did that lead to any subsequent, backlash or social media storm from his followers against you? What was the aftermath of that experience like?
It didn't surprise me. I don't know that it led to any additional backlash. From my perspective, the biggest backlash was more of a national one than anything local, and that was when I took a position on the Mueller report in favor of impeachment. And that got me a lot of people calling the office, a lot of messages, a lot of very hateful things were said. And I had a lot of, frankly, racist things said to me as well. I mean, a lot of things that I had never experienced in my life. I mentioned earlier that I'm Palestinian and Syrian ancestry.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of things that were said to me that throughout my life I had not heard. I certainly didn't hear it in my community growing up, that suddenly came out, where people were saying things to me on the phone or via email. And I took the position that I wasn't going to publicize all this stuff. I think it's a mistake when you're an elected official to go off and say like how at risk your life is and like how many people hate you and all this kind of stuff. I don't know why elected officials say that stuff. I think it's a mistake. They just make themselves a bigger target. So my view is just to keep moving, move along, and not make a big deal about it. I knew what I was doing and felt confident that I was right in what I was doing. So it didn't bother me, and doesn't bother me to this day. But as I've said, the backlash I get from the left now for criticizing Biden, it's basically similar, without a lot of the racial slurs. It might be the other way, where I'm just called a racist. You know, it's like, so in one case, the Trump people will call me, use some racial slurs, some of them, not most of them. And then the other way, the Democrats will, and some of them will say that I'm racist for holding a position. So I get hit every which way. I'm both the subject to racism and the cause of racism or something.
Tell
so
me about
like,
it. Yeah, I'm a white supremacist for not being woke enough. And then to the alt-right, I'm an authoritarian bootlicker for having some respect for government, for governance, for good governance. You'll enjoy this tweet, Justin, that I got yesterday. I tweeted, there was a journalist in Australia who interviewed the Prime Minister who's facing re-election in the next few months. And they did the usual gotcha question of how much does a loaf of bread cost and how much does a pint of milk cost? You know, I don't know if that has a long history in the States, but it's the sort of the thing that people get asked. And I tweeted, like, what is the journalist trying to do exactly here? Like, why has this become a popular thing? Like, as far as I'm concerned, unless you're below the poverty line, you're buying milk and bread regardless of what they cost, and it's just going into your shopping cart, and then you're not paying any attention to it. Like, why? Yes, if you're poor, then you know what milk costs. But is anyone under the impression that the Prime Minister is poor? Are they like is the journalist thinking that there are going to be a lot of viewers going, oh, I thought the Prime Minister was, you know, right, just scraping it by. Like, what's the point of this question? And my point was just like, if you want to see whether or not the Prime Minister is in touch, then you could ask, like, what does the average grocery cart cost? You know, like, what's the average family's grocery budget? Or you could ask, like, what does steak cost or something like that? Something where the average person actually does make a decision about whether or not to buy it or not buy it on the basis of the price. And the amount, I mean, I've had tens of thousands of tweets in the past 48 hours, Justin's talking about, oh, this could only come from a place of tremendous privilege. And like, I'm, you know, I don't understand what it's like and I don't care about food price inflation. But I thought this one was particularly good. This is from someone who says, what? Such vile, evil, insensitive creature at Josh Sepps. So just like the disgusting, evil, racist eugenics, you want to get rid of the poor, black, and so-called undesirables. Josh Sepps, you're a cancer in our nation. You are an evil seed that must be uprooted. Hashtag racist Zepps. Hashtag evil.
Oh, man. So this well, is like, the, looks like you're getting it. Yeah, same way
the,
I get it.
This is the forum in which we are, like, adjudicating and coming to agreements about what the future is important.
Do you think someone who says something like that is a real person, or
I sometimes wonder that
are these bots? I don't know. Like sometimes I get stuff, and I'm not, because increasingly people aren't using their real names. You know, it's anonymous accounts, and they say stuff like that, and you don't know whether it's just someone trolling, trying to get a reaction.
I mean, there are too many. I think. Well, who knows? But like, there are a lot. Like, and some of them are blue check marks. Like, you know, so one blue check mark person retweeted me saying, "Spoken like a man with true privilege." Is this tweet a joke? And so then I think that, you know, that's someone who knows that they're intentionally throwing red meat to their followers. Even if it is nice steak, a filet mignon, red meat to their followers, because they know that I'll be taken out of context. Like it's such, I mean, I just tweeted back to that saying like, I'm surprised that anyone took that bait. It's so easy. Like it's such an obvious thing to say about my tweet that it shows that I'm privileged because I'm out of touch with people for not understanding the price of milk, but that's not actually, I'm still waiting for you to actually refute my claim that it's a stupid question or that most people, even if they're not poor, don't actually know what milk costs. But and so then people follow up on that saying, like one says, he's just another piece of shit sucking at the public tit, he needs to be cut off. I think that's a real person. Or what's another one here? You think you're part of the normal people, Zepps? You think more absurd examples from Twitter is going to make you look normal? Normal people can see through your gaslighting from miles away, you psychopath. I think that's probably a real person. Like I don't know how the proportions break down.
Have you gotten more backlash because you've said supportive things of Joe Rogan? Has that caused some backlash or no? Like, weirdly, maybe more people just more targeting you, coming in and saying, like, look, he's one of the bad guys now?
No. Actually, the majority of the hate still comes from the anti-lockdown, freedom-loving sort of alt-righty people. I don't want to call them alt-right because some people think I mean white supremacist or like fascist. But in my lexicon, I just sort of use alt-right to mean a kind of a maybe Mike Cernovich, sort of Tim Pool kind of like ecosystem of people who are not necessarily, you know, right-wing in a conventional political spectrum, but they're like adjacent to the shit-stirring brigade who take great pride in caring more about tyrannical world government than you do and in getting hysterical about each, you know, instance of government overreach or elite media manipulation or whatever that might be. So that, I think that cohort are where I get most of my grief from, and that's probably still from stuff that I've said in public, especially on forums like Joe's show, where I'm trying to bring a bit of nuance into the conversation about under what circumstances pandemic restrictions are justified, because there's this is another area in which your cohort has gotten a bad name and has not covered itself in glory, frankly, by having a very absolutist attitude towards COVID lockdowns and restrictions. Again, I think exporting the American experience to the rest of the world so that, you know, when a lot of these people hear about, I don't know, a quarantine hotel or a quarantine facility in Australia where people are locked up for 2 weeks when they enter the country during the height of the pandemic, they think of Gavin Newsom at the French Laundry having lunch, you know, in contravention of the very rules that he has put in, or the Californian government like taking bulldozers and covering outside skate parks with sand so that teenagers can't use them. And all the or masking of children, or the shutting down of schools, all of which have not happened in Australia at all. And there's been, I think, a more, you know, you can argue about the examples of overreach, and I'm incredibly opposed to instances of police brutality or persnickety police enforcement of arcane rules. But as a general rule, those things I regard as being an independent question from the question of when is it okay for a community to enact emergency measures that require hard sort of lockdowns and clampdowns on their freedom in order to liberate themselves for the subsequent duration of the pandemic until the time is right to allow it in. Anyway, that's all a long roundabout way of saying I think it's in the weeds of that discussion that I get the majority of hate. I think most people who hate me for standing up for someone like Joe Rogan, well, for standing up not for someone like Joe Rogan, for standing up specifically for Joe Rogan during all of this, they know that they're being disingenuous, because I've never said that I agree with every single thing that he said. I'm taking a free speech attitude to this, and I don't know that you can be principled and object to that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, for me, one of the central principles of liberalism, like classical liberalism, is free speech. And so I don't know how anyone really objects to that. I always hear these arguments about the marketplace, and, well, Justin, as a libertarian, don't you support what the marketplace is doing? And if the marketplace says take Joe Rogan off the air, isn't that what you should support because you're a libertarian? But that's absurd. Libertarians don't say that we support every outcome the market produces. We're saying that the market is one of the best tools we have for achieving liberty. It's not the only tool, but it is one of the best tools we have for achieving liberty. And if the market produces an outcome that is antithetical to liberalism or freedom, then we're going to be against that outcome. And I certainly think there's a difference between objecting to someone because you have your own personal issues with them, or maybe something about their behavior you don't like, as opposed to saying someone should be taken off the air because you disagree with them or because they invite people onto their show who present information that you think is wrong. I think that there's a huge difference between those things. You know, if you want to boycott someone, boycott someone. That's your business. But that's very different from saying the reason I'm boycotting them is because I think this person should be taken off the air, and I think we need to work together to get this person off the air.
Mm. I mean, especially when it's so hypocritical, because, you know, if you're a musician and your music is still on Apple Music, I mean, what do they pay the people in Shenzhen factories making the iPhones again? Like, what, you know, like...
Right. And also, like, look at musicians just as a general rule, the kinds of things they've been able to say freely thanks to freedom of speech and put into their music over the years. They should be embracing the idea that people will challenge the system and say things that are unpopular. We can't base freedom of speech on whether we like the actual, you know, words being spoken.
No, that's actually not. Well, yeah, it's not even the point of free speech at all, because of course we right. like the, of course we like people saying things that we like. Like, that's not free speech. That's just talking.
Right.
it becomes free speech when we have to bump up against things that people saying things that we don't like.
And sometimes in America, because we have the First Amendment here, people get confused where they think that free speech is the same thing as the First Amendment, when these are different things.
Right.
The First Amendment is protecting, you know, your freedom of speech from government censorship. But and while private censorship of speech may be allowed under our system, under our Constitution, it doesn't mean that it's not an attack on free speech. Mm. You know, it can still be an assault on free speech, even if it's not protected free speech. So as a libertarian, and I think sometimes because we in America are so used to thinking of free speech and the First Amendment as almost being synonymous, like they're one and the same, we get this confused a lot, and they're not the same thing.
No, that frustrates me as well. When people, I think it's way too cute for people to be like, well, these social media companies are private companies and Spotify is a private company. Therefore, they can do whatever they want. And there's nothing inconsistent about it. It's not a First Amendment issue because the government's not doing it. And I'm like, well, would you be saying that if it was someone who you cared about, like, or if it was you being excluded right. from these platforms? These are the places where the public has conversations with itself. Like, you know, if you're not on there, then you're not really able to speak. How do we, Justin, I want to let you go, but how do we turn the volume down on all this? I mean, if you you can take this in one of two directions, or we can do both. I think there's a political thing that I'm interested in your thoughts on, and then there's a cultural thing that I'm interested in your thoughts on. Politically, if you run in 2024, I assume you'll run as a libertarian. If Trump is the Republican nominee, you may split the non-democratic vote and you may enable the Democrat to win. You can either prognosticate about that or you can pass on that prognostication. And then the cultural question is, I feel like we're all just dialed up to 11 all the time. And the woke left is emboldening the right-wing Trumpy crazies, and they are emboldening the woke left, and people who can reasonably disagree about things in the center are left holding their dicks in their hands, as my grandfather would have said, and not being invited to the party. How do we change that dynamic?
So for the first one, you know, I don't know whether I'll run for president or run for any office in the next few years. But I would say when someone runs for election, they're not causing someone else to win or lose. You know, people get to go and vote for whoever they want on the ballot. And they can vote for a Democrat. They can vote for a Republican. They can vote for a Libertarian. They can vote for someone else if they want. And if we take this mindset that anytime someone is on the ballot who's not a Republican or Democrat, that it is just helping one of the other two parties, then you are just perpetuating the problem. Like, the problem never gets resolved. And there are millions of people, I'd say a plurality of Americans, who prefer some alternative. They're tired of being tied down to the Republican nominee or the Democratic nominee. When you look at polling on this, independents outnumber Republicans and Democrats, and it's getting to the point where they outnumber them easily. You know, it's a significant margin by which they outnumber them. Why shouldn't all of those people have someone to vote for? They are largely voting for the two candidates, Republican or Democrat, because they've been left with few options. There hasn't been a serious alternative that's been presented, and to the extent we've been getting candidates in the past they have been less serious because of the narrative, because of the narrative that they can't win. And so even the people who run for these positions are not as strong as they could be. So I think we just have to break through that. Someone has to say, I'm going to do it. I'm doing it regardless of how it impacts the other two candidates. And if you don't like me, don't vote for me. And if you want to, you know, if you want to vote for the other candidates, go for it. But if you want something different, vote for me. Again, I haven't decided what I'll do in the future and what office I'll run for if I run for any office. But I do think that libertarians and independents and people in other parties have to be bold and say, we're going to challenge this. But we also have to work on our election system here in the United States. I think that election reforms where you have things like ranked choice voting or other alternative methods for electing people would be extremely beneficial, because with a first past the post system like we have in most of the United States, and the design of our Constitution, you inevitably create a two-party system. You know, it's kind of inevitable with this type of system. That doesn't mean these two parties must endure. It doesn't mean that one of the two parties couldn't be replaced by the Libertarian Party or by another party. But it does mean that you tend toward creating two strong parties. And one thing that could help break that up is having a different election system where people run essentially on their individual qualifications and character. And we have ranked choice voting, and people have more of an opportunity to get by, even if they are not tied to one of the two old parties. So that's what I would say about that. As for, you know, how do we get past this point culturally, like where we're at? I'd go back to what I said before. If you decide everything in one central repository in Washington, D.C., if you put all the eggs in one basket and say, this is it, whoever controls this basket here controls everything, then of course you're going to get all of this fighting. Of course you're going to have people thinking it's a life or death struggle. And I can tell you that it's increasingly difficult for me to convince people on the right that the proper outcome is liberal democracy, that the proper approach is some kind of system where we all decide things together and there's the rule of law and we try to live peacefully with each other. Increasingly, people, I think, believe there's a big fight coming, and it's like a life or death struggle for them is how they view it.
Yeah.
And that if they don't stand up and fight, they're like, well, we're just sitting ducks. You know, they'll say to me, Justin, you're being naive. Like, they might agree with me on a lot of my principles. They might agree with me on a lot of what I believe in libertarianism, but they'll say, but where you libertarians get it wrong, they'll say, is that you still believe in the system. And we, the people telling me this, don't believe in the system. We think you're wrong to believe in it. They increasingly think the founders were wrong about the system they designed, that it's not compatible with liberty, that essentially you have to defeat your enemies at this point. And there's no way around it. It's just one side's going to win and one side's going to lose. And are you going to stand with them or are you going to stand with us? And that's how it's increasingly framed. And the left is helping to fuel, I think, all of this by not understanding why some on the right are skeptical about centralized power, concentrated power, restrictions on freedom of speech, why people on the right are concerned about all that stuff. I think that if people could learn to live within their own communities and think about what's going on in their own areas and help the people around them instead of worrying about people who are halfway across the country all the time, and what are they doing, and how are they running their school, and how are they running their police department? I think we'd all be a lot better off. But again, this requires us to push things away from Washington, push things out of the the centralized system that we have. And I don't know how you get there except through education and conversations and efforts at persuasion. I don't know how it's going to happen any other way. It's not going to happen spontaneously through government. You know, the Congress is not going to wake up and say, we got to do things differently. And neither is the White House.
The answer to our problems will be President Amash, the first libertarian president in 2024. Justin, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for your time. I'm so glad that we were able to connect.
Thanks, Josh. I really enjoyed it. And maybe I'll have you on my podcast sometime.
I'd love to
talk to you.
Yeah, no,
I'd love to talk to you about it. I just started it. It's not fancy like yours.
I just saw it come up when I was Googling you earlier, and I felt embarrassed that I hadn't listened to it, but I look forward to hearing it, the Justin Amash podcast. Yeah,
thank you. It's nothing fancy, but you know, I'd love to talk about Australia. I love talking about these kinds of things and
trying to understand. Because I think there'll be an interesting difference of opinion between, and a constructive one, between probably your worldview and the utterly perplexing worldview of the Australian lockdowners, which I can hopefully articulate.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I think exchanging ideas, learning about people from other places is the way forward. You know, we have to try to understand each other and bridge all those differences.
All right.
And accept those differences, you know.
Good on you, Justin. We'll speak again, and if I ever find myself wandering across the frosty plains of Michigan, I will give you a call.
All right. Thanks, Josh. Man. Really appreciate it.
Uncomfortable Conversations is produced by Stefan Postuma. Follow me, Josh Sepps, on Twitter and Instagram for all the latest. May your day be fruitful, your mind humble, your enemies generous, and your conversations perfectly, sparklingly, delectably uncomfortable.